Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on Ohio's political news and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Today at the roundtable, I'm joined by Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. Great to be here.
Daryl Roland, politics and investigative reporter for ABC. Hi, Daryl.
Good to be with you again, Anna.
And Shane Stegmiller, Hannah News Service reporter. Welcome back.
Good morning.
So news broke over the weekend that a small group of neo-Nazis marched in Columbus's Short North District Saturday afternoon. The group wore black clothes with red face masks and shouted racial slurs. No arrests were made, but Governor Mike DeWine said, quote, "There is no place in this state for hate, bigotry, anti-Semitism, or violence." City Council President Shannon Harden placed the blame on newly elected President Donald Trump, saying he has emboldened these kinds of creeps. Daryl, police got involved, but no arrests were made. What was the point of all this?
To gather attention and make us talk about it, I think.
Which, well, it worked.
Yeah, kind of makes me feel dirty for, you know, giving into it. I don't know. It wasn't, you know, I'm not up on the vernacular enough to know the differences between the Nazi and the neo-Nazi. I saw the swastika.
Or the Proud Boys and the this
red
and that.
And, you know, instead of the traditional black on white. The White House actually condemned that this morning, saying, you know, kind of like Mike DeWine's statement yesterday, no room in America for this sort of thing. So, you know, it's amazing. Probably a dozen or fewer people get
this
statewide and national attention for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Shannon Harden, you mentioned his tweet, you know, basically blame it. You know, this is what the Trump era hath wrought. And he got jumped on pretty heavily by a bunch of people saying, you know, Tommy rot, if you will.
Yeah. You know, this incident follows a Nazi demonstration in Michigan earlier this month outside of a play about the Diary of Anne Frank. So what I find fascinating is that it seems to be these small incidents with small groups of people that, Jeremy, almost seem tailor-made for social media. Like, that's the whole point.
That's the whole point. And that's, as Daryl said, the point here is publicity. I mean, when you have a march of any kind and you're waving giant flags, no matter what's on the flag, the point is to get publicity. And they certainly got publicity, you know, for a relatively small march. That, like, this wasn't Charlottesville.
No.
But it got a lot of publicity.
Yeah,
I mean, as well
it
should.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's not like people should ignore things like this, but their point was to get people to notice them, and people have definitely noticed them.
Yeah. I don't know that there's much else to say, so let's move on to lame duck. State lawmakers are back in session. They have only a few weeks left to get everything they want done before this General Assembly comes to a close. And one of the Senate's first acts was to pass a controversial bill. The bill, if signed into law, would say students at K-12 schools and colleges can only use a bathroom or a locker room of the gender they were assigned at birth. And in true lame duck fashion, Shane, this bill was folded into another bill about college credit for high schoolers.
Yes, and this was done right before they went on their summer break at the last minute. Democrats accused the Senate Republicans of course, this is the first thing you're going to bring up in our first session back, but the Senate president said, well, this is the first chance we actually had a chance to actually look at this and pass it. It's the season for giving. You see all these kinds of Christmas tree bills where they start hanging little ornaments on it. And this is the way you move something that may be stalled out. You might see the higher ed bill get attached to a whole bunch of stuff. You might see some voting stuff start getting attached to a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
You never know what's going to just suddenly wake up and move real quick.
Yeah, and that's kind of how it works, right? They attach it to something that's sort of tangentially related. So college credit, bill about schools and bathrooms. They kind of fit in the same umbrella of education.
They do, and the Supreme Court hasn't smacked them down on single subject for a long time. So
yeah.
Even if you just have a tangential subject, it's likely going to be upheld. It's not likely to survive a single subject challenge.
Yeah, that's like the locust coming back that about every 10 years or so, the Supreme Court smacks them down. And then the rest of the decade, they kind of ignored that constitutional requirement. I think what a lot of people, Anna, were objecting to was since this was a Senate bill originally, the House amended it, the Senate merely concurred in the House amendments. And that means there were no committee hearings, no one got to speak on the bill, for or against. It just went straight to the floor and a vote. And it's, you know, this is obviously the farthest this has ever gotten. You know, first it got through the House, now is the first, and things like that. So then climbing this ladder, if you will, toward this this legislation. And the governor has said, you know, depending on the final version of it, he probably would sign it.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see what he does. He has 10 days, I believe, from the day he receives it, which is, it's a whole process. You got to print a special version of the bill. Then the Senate president has to sign it. Then the House has to sign it. Then they have
it.
Yeah, that's what it. And then, so I don't know that it's actually gotten to his desk yet and that the clock has actually started, but he can't run it out to the end of the year. He's not going to get that much time.
Speaker Stevens already posted a picture of him signing it on social media, so I'm not sure when it's going to hit DeWine's desk.
The vote broke down the way you would expect. Republicans voting yes for the bathroom bill and Democrats voting no. Here's Democratic Minority Leader in the Senate, Nikki Antonio.
So once again, we're going to pass a bill. Lawyers will have work to do, which is awesome. Our children will hear these messages that we should fear a group of people who just want to be their authentic selves, just want to live their lives.
Jeremy, Republican Jerry Serino said the bill was offered with no animus towards students experiencing, quote, gender issues, and that it makes as many accommodations as possible. I've been trying to decipher what accommodations the legislation makes.
To be honest, I haven't really been following the debate over this bill. I do know that there's at least a good chance that this is going to end up in court.
Yeah. ACLU's already sniffing around the idea.
But I mean, as to what you're saying about that Senator Serino offering all these concessions, I wouldn't. I would defer to my colleagues on that.
That's fair. Oh, Shane.
I think some of the language, it allows for some of those family style bathrooms,
Like unisex bathrooms,
like a unisex bathroom. Also, they made some exceptions for, you know, people helping their kids if they're under like the age of 10. So, you know, sometimes if you have children.
Like if my husband's out with the girls and, I mean, they're getting to the age where they can go by themselves, but when they were littler, they couldn't.
Right, exactly. And I think it also, it might include like disabilities in that too.
No, that makes sense. Shane, this was the first big thing to pass in lame duck. What do you think is next on the agenda?
Well, you never know, but among the things that I think they're going to try and quickly take up and pass is this infrastructure bond issue, renewing that. They have to get that done by the end of the year, likely, if they want to get it on the May ballot. It should be something that's non-controversial, so I expect it to pick up and move fast. I think it's got bipartisan sponsors in the House.
And the Senate, too.
And the Senate, okay. And then Senate President Matt Huffman has said that he wants to address the Delta 8 THC debate. He's kind of on the same page with Governor DeWine, saying we need to do something about that. The House has been a little more behind on it. I don't know if they can come to a conclusion or if they just kind of feel like the voters have spoken on it, so we kind of got to be careful what we do and what we don't do.
Yeah, I think, Daryl, the reason that the Delta 8 legislation hasn't moved is because it's been part of a larger marijuana reform bill. So I wonder if they're going to break it out as just... So Delta 8 is what they call like diet weed. It's made from hemp, but it can get you high and it can be sold in gas stations and you don't need to be 18 to buy it. And it's this whole thing. But I think legislation on just that probably could move, but the question is, right, will they separate that from a larger marijuana reform package?
Well, that's a good question. An even bigger question, of course, we're now concluding this legislative session, obviously, which is why we have lame duck. Their terms all the House members and, you know, half the Senate members expire. So it's now or never in a lot of this stuff. But we've just gone through 2 years of the House being so inactive, historically inactive. I know at least Jeremy, I think, has chronicled that. will that pattern continue into lame duck? Because, yeah, lame duck is usually the rush to get out the door and last chance to pass things. Or will they continue to be dysfunctional because of leadership issues?
Speaking of that, that's the perfect pivot into a vote that they're going to take this week, potentially, on who will be the new Speaker of the Ohio House. Jeremy, can you remind us who's running for this job?
So this is a long time coming, and it's right now it's Jason Stevens, the current Speaker, who, as listeners might remember, got controversially elected in 2023 because he, even though he didn't have a majority of his own Republican caucus, he got Democratic votes and was elected. And he is going to very likely be contested by Matt Huffman, the Senate president, who was term limited in the Senate. So he ran for a House seat, got elected unopposed. And it's going to be Stevens, Huffman. And then there's talk about even more people entering the speaker's race. And exactly who you talk to provides different names. And one name being thrown around is State Representative Ron Ferguson, who's been a anti-Stevens critic for sure, but at the same time doesn't seem to be fully behind Matt Huffman too. So who's ahead and who's going to win this depends on who you talk to. It looks like, taken together, it looks like Matt Huffman is the favorite going in, but it's hardly a done deal, it seems, at this point. This is going to be a secret vote that's held behind closed doors at the Ohio State House. It's the equivalent of, you know, us waiting outside, us reporters waiting outside to see if the white smoke comes out and see who they pick. And then there's the question, of course, of this is just an unofficial caucus vote. But then the question is, will that result in January when they hold the floor vote of Democrats having some say and having a Stevens style, you know, usurping what the will of the Republicans is? It seems that's much less likely this time around. People are much less likely, especially the blowback all the pro-Stevens voters got in the wake of that. But we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, I am really curious. So, yeah, there's a couple different outcomes. Like, Huffman could have a majority of caucus, but not a majority of the Ohio House.
Yeah, that's what we saw two years ago.
Yeah. Right.
And with Larry Householder, too.
Yeah, but unlike Larry Householder, Stevens didn't seem able to, like, coalesce the Republican caucus behind him. Now, Householder, turned out, had $61 million in bribe money that he could use to squash people who spoke out against him. So, you know, I'm not saying that that's a fault of Jason Stevens. I'm just saying Householder was a different character.
Right. And I think it's going to come down to, you know, Dems, I'm sure they'll try to cut their best deal. And again, they don't have much negotiating room. I mean, this is like the only time, really, that they really have true power in the House. They can be kingmaker here, possibly.
I mean, when you're in a super minority, this is the best deal you got.
They did pick up two seats in the election, so that kind of cuts the number of, you know, people that the Republicans have to vote. Though, you know, the Republicans are also losing some of the Stevens, people who voted for Stevens, like Bill Seitz, Al Catrona went over to the Senate.
John Cross. Lost his primary, will be replaced.
And yes. What's at stake here is this is not an ideological battle, first and foremost.
They're both conservative.
They're both pretty conservative, and they agree on most, not all issues. This is just about power. This is just a power, good old-fashioned power struggle. And there are a few issues that they disagree on. Like, for example, Stevens was initially resistant to expanding school vouchers the way that Huffman wanted to. Things like
the higher
right
bill
to work seems to be, they have ideological differences, some there,
yeah.
Things like that. So there are some differences there, but this is just kind of a power struggle. And then the Democrats got concessions from Stevens in last year's budget in exchange for giving their support, and they'll be trying to maximize that again.
And the Democrats, how angry are they at Matt Huffman? I mean, Matt Huffman was right in the middle of all the redistricting fights and was very, very partisan involved in that. He was just involved with some, let's say, creative claims against State Issue 1 that would have reformed that whole process just earlier this month. Will Democrats remember that, and will that give them less incentive to back him? I don't know.
Yeah, I have to say my favorite quote about lame duck comes from outgoing Representative Bill Seitz of the Cincinnati area. He told Signal statewide that we have 27 or 28 members leaving, so you can expect to hear farewell speeches until you puke.
Mm-hmm. We're going to miss Bill Seitz on the reporting side for his good quotes.
Yeah, his very colorful language. No word yet on who Governor DeWine is going to pick to replace J.D. Vance in the Senate. The New York Post cited sources saying it's down to two people, Jane Timken, former Ohio Republican Party chair, and Vivek Ramaswamy. But Vivek has taken himself out of consideration after getting a job in Trump's White House. Jeremy, that leaves Timken.
It leaves Timken, and as I'll explain why, it's just my informed speculation, I have no inside track on it, is that I personally consider her the favorite right now. There's others, of course, who are interested, or, you know, rumors are flying around, you know, there's so many names, but others I've heard include State Treasurer Robert Sprague, U.S. Representative Warren Davidson, U.S. Representative Mike Carey. And there's just a whole lot of different factors to weigh in here. And what you look at what DeWine wants to do is he wants to find someone, by all accounts, who is MAGA enough for Donald Trump and Trump world, but is moderate enough for Mike DeWine to be comfortable with. So someone who can strike that balance. And then the other thing he's prioritizing is someone who can get elected. So whoever's appointed to this seat to fill J.D. Vance's seat, which is opening up because he's becoming vice president, would have to run in a special election in 2026. And if that person wins in 2026, they'd have to run again in 2028 for a full term. So he wants someone who can not only, you know, strike that balance between the sides of the Republican Party, but is also able to win. And you could argue Jane Timken checks a lot of boxes for him. She's a former Ohio Republican Party chair who...
She'd be the first female U.S. senator from Ohio.
That is definitely part of it, especially as Mike DeWine is thinking legacy as he's leaving the governor's mansion in a couple of years himself. One possible strike against her is that when she ran for Senate in 2022, she finished fifth and got less than 6% of the vote. So some people are saying, well, that raises questions if she can win the way DeWine wants her to win. The timing of this depends on when Vance leaves the Senate seat. And we haven't gotten any instructions or a formal notification when that'll be. Just from what my understanding is that he might not want to leave until after the first of the year.
After their own lame duck is over.
After their own lame duck, the U.S. Senate's lame duck is over. And if that's the case, so even if Timken right now is a favorite, if Vance left now and DeWine appointed, and I just ask Jason Stevens how having more time allows you to take the favorite and have more time to launch a campaign to kind of change that dynamic. So we'll see what happens in the coming weeks.
And let's face it, what they need is someone who can beat Sherrod Brown in 2 years. Because it's looking like, you know, he hasn't talked a whole lot, but what he has said is, I'm not leaving the game. I mean, he will be in his, you know, early to mid-70s by then. 73, I believe, to be exact.
Chicken by today's standards.
Well, yeah, exactly, especially for the Senate, you know, where you have 90-year-old members and all that. And that's going to be, and you figure this is not necessarily a good time demographically for new administrations, you know, that first midterm into the presidency. You know, Donald Trump is going to carry out his pledges, as it sure seems. He's talking about, you know, mobilizing the military, starting that deportation. Maybe that'll all go swimmingly, but it's going to cause a lot of foment in this country the next 2 years. Sherrod Brown might look attracted to more people. And I don't think we maybe should not write off Frank LaRose, even though he's kind of, you know, by the by. He introduced Bernie Moreno like the last several months of the campaign, so he's definitely tight with him and perhaps with Vance as well.
Coming up, former Speaker Larry Householder's plan to get out of prison. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Daryl Roland, politics and investigative reporter for ABC6, and Shane Stegmiller, Hannah News Service reporter. There's been a lot of talk about who Trump may pardon when he becomes president, whether those from the January 6 riot will be pardoned, and also here in Ohio, former Speaker Larry Householder is hoping to get his own get-out-of-jail-free card from the president-elect. Householder was convicted of orchestrating a $61 million bribery scheme to bail out two nuclear power plants. He's now serving 20 years of a federal prison sentence. Jeremy, presidents can't offer pardons or clemency. Sounds like Householder would really take either at this point.
As his campaign attorney told me, he said, we'll take what we can get here.
Either one sends him home.
Either one sends him home. And the real, I mean, Householder, from my understanding, still would be able to run for public office if and when he's released, even if he's a federal felon. I don't know all the details about that. But right now, the goal is just to get him out of prison. Right now, he's in a low security federal prison south of Youngstown. And why not? I think the thinking is, what do we have to lose? Like, if we don't get it, we don't get it. But no reason we shouldn't try to do this. And they've also taken pains to publicize it, too. This wasn't something that, you know, the press corps just uncovered in the dead of night or something. They've been very forward with making sure they get as much press coverage about this as possible.
Yeah, Daryl, Trump and Householder definitely know each other. Householder was an early Trump supporter here in Ohio. He spoke at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland in 2016, and he famously, or perhaps infamously, flew on First Energy's jet to Trump's inauguration. So, I mean, the two men have a history. It's not completely out of the blue.
Boy, this just seems like a bird is just not going to get off the ground, in my view. And the other thing is, we still have some state charges, and that would be that Trump can't do anything about.
I mean, no, but Householder could go home until that case plays out.
Right, and yeah, sure. You know, you fight that battle tomorrow. But I can't see Ohioans being too much in favor of this. So, again, no one's gotten rich predicting the future with Donald Trump, so anything can happen. But it just seems like a lose-lose all the way around, in my view.
Yeah, Shane, I wonder if his best case, Householder's, is that he says that he's being persecuted for his politics. Householder's always maintained his innocence. He says this was business as usual, that he says they're twisting what he did. He's being persecuted. Sounds a little bit like the president-elect.
Yes, and if he can get the president-elect's attention with his case, he can make the case, look, I was prosecuted by an overzealous Justice Department, and that will probably play very well.
It might resonate.
Though keep in mind that the investigation, the federal investigation that led to him being arrested, was overseen by the U.S. attorney who was appointed by Trump, Dave DeVillers.
Yes.
And obviously now it's being, prosecuted by Joe Biden's U.S. attorney. But there's layers to this. It's not as cut and dry as,
No. Oh,
it's the liberals going after me. There's more layers to it than that.
Yeah, Jeremy, your colleague Jake Zuckerman reported on former First Energy lobbyist Joel Bailey being questioned under oath last week. He's not been charged, but he did invoke his right against self-incrimination about 100 times. So this is all pertains to the state case, I should say, not the federal case. Federal case is over. This is the state case.
This is, and I have a feeling that it's not going to just be Bailey who's invoking their Fifth Amendment right to not incriminate themselves here. This isn't the end of the investigation. It didn't end with Householder. As you said, they're going after a number of others now. And the question in my mind is running up against the statute of limitations. There's usually a 5-year statute of limitations.
We're kind of upon it right now.
We're, if not past it, because yeah. House Bill 6 was passed in the summer of 2019. Obviously, we're in November 2024. So we'll see. The problem here is that U.S. Attorney's Offices and the Justice Department, they don't come out and say, hey, here's what our plan is. They play their cards very, very close to the chest until one day all of a sudden you hear word that they busted down someone's door and, you know, served a search warrant and arrested them.
Yeah. If you're very lucky, you get a like 30 minute to an hour heads up that they're going to like ransack someone's house. But that's about it.
If we're lucky.
Yeah.
So no one, I feel that's very, very few people know exactly what the plan is here. We just kind of get an idea through things like this that something is going on.
Yeah. So we'll have to wait and see what happens next. You know, Shane, that's always been a little bit of like press corps tinfoil hat game of how far will the charges go? Will it lead to the executive office? Will it lead here? Will it lead there? And I suppose, who knows?
Exactly. It's like Jeremy said, the government doesn't automatically tell you what they're going to do before they do it. And who knows what, you know, Attorney General Dave Yost is also working on as well with his state case.
Yeah. Speaking of Dave Yost, he may or may not, well, he probably obviously is eyeing being governor in 2026. And a lot of people are starting to think about the next election, even though the ink on this one is barely dry. Senator Sherrod Brown spoke with Politico's Eugene Daniels last week for the Politico Playbook Deep Dive. And, you know, he was asked, will you run for Vance's vacant seat in 2026? And he says he's, quote, ruled nothing out. Jeremy, he's also on a lot of Democratic shortlists for governor in 2026.
Yeah, I get the idea for the governor talk, though, that the main reason he's on those lists is people think, hey, who would the Dems be able to run for governor in 2026? Oh, Sherrod Brown's, he'll be free. What's he going to be up to? And so that's not to say that I have any information that he's not going to run. I think Daryl made the point earlier that if he does run in 2026, it would probably be for Senate at this point. I mean, who's to say? We'll find out. And as Daryl said, it could be there's like a lot of good reasons to do that. It would be like traditionally
the
party that doesn't hold the White House does better in the midterms. There's not a lot of other potential Democratic flip seats coming up, except for, say, I think North Carolina and Maine with Tom Tillis and Susan Collins. So he would be a top priority for the DSCC and, you know, the National Senate Democrats. But on the other hand,
Mike DeWine won't be on the ballot. Very popular governor.
Won't be on the ballot. But on the other hand, you know, Sherrod, as Daryl also said, he's 72. And so if he ran for Senate in 2026 and won, and he would have to run again in 2028, and if he got one in 2028, he would serve a full 6-year term. So that would mean three pretty grueling campaigns in a row, 2024, 26, 28. And if he wins all three, then he'd be in the Senate till 2034 when he'd be 82 years old. So, you know, if you're Sherrod Brown, you kind of ask yourself, is this all worth it? Do I want to do this? Or, you know, do I want to do what many senators do, you know, serve on a couple of corporate boards and then go home to Connie and, you know, not have to put myself through what I just put myself through?
Enjoy the grandkids.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think he wants to go out like Muhammad Ali, go out on a stool, so to speak. Mm. I could see him doing it again. And you're right about I remember Joe Hal and I were fortunate. We kind of got a little tour of the Senate floor and all that when obviously they weren't in session or anything. But there are these like phone booth like things in the back that date from, I don't know, like colonial times or something, that they are signed by seniority. And he just made the remark, as only Sherrod Brown can, it's like, there's going to have to be a lot of people die before I qualify for one of these. Mm. But, yeah, you know, he might there. You know, presumably Chuck Grassley is going to hang on forever and, you know, a bunch of other seniors in that club.
One advantage that Sherrod Brown has that other Democrats do not have is he has the luxury of taking his time to make a decision. And so I anticipate most Democratic candidates for 2026 will probably announce after the first of the year or around then. Sherrod doesn't have to make that decision.
He could wait till late summer.
He could wait till late summer. And then when he enters, I anticipate that a lot, not all, he would probably still have a primary, but a lot of this, other serious candidates who would have already entered the race would get out of the race. The Dems don't want a situation where all their A-list, their best candidates are running in one race. So Sherrod has time to make this decision.
Another name from lawmaking past is Tim Ryan, who had originally ruled out running for office in 2026, but told Signal statewide he's reevaluating that following the November 5th election. So Tim Ryan could also be back in the mix of things. I see him more as running for governor, but who knows?
He told me back in August when at the DNC that he was not interested, flat not interested in running in 2026. But now it looks he's reexamining that. And if
well, you're not running until you say you're not running. I mean, you're not run. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not over till it's over, yeah. You know. If Scherer doesn't run, I would imagine that the DSCC would probably, the Democratic Senate caucus would look to Tim Ryan or maybe someone like Amelia Sykes or something. But they would probably, they would definitely ask Tim Ryan if he's interested, I would imagine.
Yeah. President-elect Donald Trump has started building his cabinet. The picks run the gambit from more traditional choices like Marco Rubio for Secretary of State to controversial picks like former Congressman Matt Gaetz for Attorney General. Trump's also creating a brand new commission, not an agency, which I find a little confusing since it's called the Department of Government Efficiency, but Ohio's own Vivek Ramaswamy will run it with Elon Musk. Here's Vivek talking about how he plans to cut $2 trillion, with a T, dollars from the federal budget.
So what do we want to do? We want to go in and slash and burn that bureaucracy to help Americans, stimulate the economy, and to restore self-governance again, Sean. The people we elect to run the government, they're not even the ones who run the government anymore. It's these unelected bureaucrats. Republican politicians have talked about fixing this for a long time, not with a lot of progress. So I do think it's going to take a couple of outsiders. Elon and I have built a great friendship over the last year. We're working together intensely, and we're not going to stop till we get the job done.
So, Shane, he sounds excited for his new job. Definitely doesn't sound like he's going to seek a U.S. Senate seat now.
No, and he's been talking about doing this for a while. He made a speech here in Columbus not that long ago to the Impact Ohio right after the election, where he was talking about how they wanted to do this. And he also kind of laid out the blueprint of how he might go about it. You know, they're going to rely on some of these Supreme Court decisions that have come out since Trump was last in office, you know, getting rid of the Chevron deference and such. I think you'll see. They kind of indicated maybe they'll do a lot of executive actions at the beginning while they try and rally up Congress to do the rest of the stuff. But I expect to see a flurry of executive actions. The other thing, too, is, though, I mean, it's not an official government agency. So anything that they do is going to have to just be a recommendation. And then you have to get Trump and Congress to go along with it. And
yeah. That's the part where it's a commission, not an actual agency, mm-hmm. even though it's called the Department of Government Efficiency. So don't let the name confuse you. But yeah, Daryl, presidents, though, have a lot of latitude when it comes to what happens within agencies.
Well, certainly in his first term, President Trump pushed the edge in a lot of things. And as Shane astutely pointed out, he's been given even more greater reign by the Supreme Court decisions and, frankly, by what he and his supporters are, perhaps not wrongly, is a mandate. I mean, all of this is coming as no surprise to the American electorate, if anyone was awake at all, you know, the mass deportations and all of this. Interestingly, Ramaswamy has talked about in the last, at least the last couple of months where I've heard him, of two mass deportations are needed. One is the one, you know, send the undocumented immigrants back to where they came from. And the other is deporting all the bureaucrats in Washington. Now, that always sounds good. That's like eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse. You know, what are all those bureaucrats doing? Well, you're going to find out quite a lot. Again, details have not emerged of anything, but they're talking about, you know, wiping out things like the National Weather Service or things like that. And
Department of Education's on the chopping block.
Yeah. And which, you know, people with special needs children, you know, some of those are federal issues. So we start getting into these actual cuts. People might have a greater affection for bureaucrats once they find out, hey, wait, these are actually useful people.
And Elon Musk at least has talked about cutting $2 trillion from the federal.
That's nothing to sneeze at. That's a lot of cuts.
And if you look about how to do that, it's not easy to do that, especially because something like 60% of government spending is things like Medicaid, Social Security, defense spending, things that Trump himself has said, I'm not going to cut. And so when you get to things like federal workers. There's 2.3 million civilian federal workers right now. And they make a total of about $350, $360 billion when you include their their salary and then their health benefits and all that. Even if you laid off all of them, that doesn't get you to $2 trillion. And more than 60% of those workers work for either the Department of Defense, Veterans Affairs, or Homeland Security, who they do things like patrol
federal
the border.
Forest rangers, like...
So
all kinds of things.
There have been commissions like this before, dating back to Teddy Roosevelt. Ronald Reagan had a commission. Al Gore had a commission. And those commissions had resulted in some changes, but they always consistently fell short of their goals. So we'll see if they're able to do any better this time around. But it's going to be real tough sledding, especially because they're operating outside of government. It's really going to be up to Congress. If they want to cut $2 trillion, that's going to be Congress doing it, not an advisory board.
And they also have a very aggressive timeline as when they're trying to get this done. And we all know that Washington doesn't move very fast.
Yeah, they want to be done by July 4th, 2026, which is obviously
that's
the
tight.
Anniversary of the Declaration of Independence.
Coming up. Why an outgoing Democratic lawmaker is suing a bunch of his colleagues. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Daryl Rowland, politics and investigative reporter for ABC6, and Hannah News Service reporter Shane Stegmiller. Democrat Elliot Forehand has sued a bunch of lawmakers and state officials. He alleges they put out a political hit job on him. Among those listed in his 110-page complaint is Ohio House Democrat Allison Russo, Juanita Brent, Republican House Speaker Jason Stevens, Republican Attorney General Dave Yost. Jeremy, this goes back to May 2023 and a series of incidents. Can you remind us what happened and how Forehand ended up in this position?
So this stemmed from House Democrats making a number of allegations, detailing a list of what they said was dangerous and apoplectic behavior, where he would make very threatening comments to other lawmakers and aides and
constituents
in some cases too, just a variety of different concerning comments. And it led Jason Stevens, House Speaker, to take away his state house badge so he can't get in the to the state house without permission, take away his legislative aide. But what Forehand at least told me last week is the big what he's trying to do is not only get justice, because he thinks all these allegations are lies, or at least that's what he says, but that he was professionally harmed by this and he's trying to get his life back from it. He said that his main client at his law firm dropped him, that he was an adjunct professor at Kent State University and they decided not to rehire him. And
he lost his primary earlier this year.
Yeah, and that he lost his primary earlier this year.
So he'll
year.
Be leaving so office.
He kind of, this is designed for him to restore his, in his mind, his professional reputation and try to get his life back.
Yeah, Shane, he leaves office at the end of this year, but it sounds like, essentially, is he looking for money to move on? It seems to be, or just sort of a little bit of vindication.
I think it's more vindication. He's been kind of marginalized since almost the beginning of the session by the caucus, and I mean the speaker has gone along with the
When you're ostracized, you can't get stuff done in the legislature,
right? I mean, he's had to put out his own press releases. I don't think he's had the option of using the caucus to put out his own stuff. So He's you can tell he's angry.
Well, we'll see where that lawsuit goes. It will, as most legal proceedings, probably conclude well after Representative Forehan has left office.
It's going to take a while, especially because the Court of Claims, which is a separate court, has to first rule on whether all these people have immunity for working for the state. So it's going to take a while.
The state teachers' retirement system has a new interim director, Aaron Hood. Daryl, this pension plan, STRS, has been plagued by infighting, accusation of mismanagement. Like, this has been going on for years. We've talked about it quite a bit on the roundtable. Mm. Any chance they're finally turning a corner here?
Well, we see. I mean, who may, you know, again, this is the interim director while they search for a permanent director. You're right. Turmoil has been the, you know, I think STRS, sometimes you think the T stands for turmoil. You know, part of it is the demographics of retired teachers. First of all, don't make a bunch of educated folks angry because they know how to fight back pretty well.
And they have time to do it.
They have time to do it. They retire. They just demographically, they live longer. So their pensions finances are a little bit different than like for police and firefighters and all those who...
And they haven't had a COLA, or they have, but they went a couple years without it, longer than some of the other pension plans. They thought this was mismanagement. They got upset.
Right. Yeah, they thought the investment team just did a bad. And when I say they now, this is a group of teachers. Saying, yeah, we're paying you guys all this, and this is all we're getting. And, you know, now we're talking about, you know, changing the retirement, lowering the retirement age and all that. So... You know, the numbers can be made to lie, but the numbers themselves don't lie. So I think you got some real fundamentals to overcome.
A lot of trust to rebuild.
And a lot of trust to rebuild, yeah.
And this is something that's been going on for years. I know a lot of retired teachers who've been grumbling about, you know, whether they feel that STRS has been spending their pension money wisely, if you know, whether they're spending too much giving big bonuses to, you know, investment specialists who, you know, may not be getting a great return, or whether they're spending money on big buildings in downtown Columbus or what have you. This is something that's going on for years.
Yeah. If you're sick of voting on statewide ballot initiatives, I have some bad news for you. Ohio lawmakers plan to ask voters to increase the bond allowance to help governments repair bridges, roads, and other infrastructure. The State Capital Improvement Project has bipartisan support, and it could be on our ballot, Shane, this May.
Yes, as I said earlier, they will have to try and get it done out of the legislature by the end of the year. It will have to come through a joint resolution, which has already been introduced. Both chambers have indicated they want to move quickly on it, and the good news is this is a pretty bipartisan, widely supported thing, so we won't be inundated with a lot of election ads for it.
It's just about raising how much we can bond out against, right? It's
exactly.
For cost of construction,
and,
essentially.
You know, it only goes for so many years that they have this bonding authority, so they have to renew it every so often.
And thank the heavens, it'll be called Issue 2.
Yes.
Under a new law that changes how things are numbered, so we don't have an issue one, a new issue one every single year.
For many, many years. Yeah. So this will be issue two, which makes my life so much easier. So, Daryl, I want to talk to you about a story that you recently did about the goings-on at the Circleville Police Department. There was a 34-page investigation about sexual misconduct within the department. Can you tell us what's happening there?
Yeah, Circleville seems to be the gift that keeps on giving as far as news and news that sort of, you know, makes your eyes grow wide. You know, just to review, just the past several months, they've tossed a canine officer.
Oh, that's right. That was,
yeah. For disobeying commands of a highway patrol trooper.
That video made a lot of news.
Yeah. They ended up paying him money because I think they kind of messed up on how they let
him
go.
Yeah, the officer in charge, I believe, right, from another department was like, don't release the dog, and then he released the dog.
Yeah, on an unarmed guy who was surrendering. So that did not go over well. A safety director was hired supposedly to clean house. He was gone in a week. And then the chief and the deputy chief were fired earlier this year. I shouldn't say fired. They came to a separation agreement, and again, the city paid out, I don't know, like $170,000 combined to the two of them. So now we have an incident that actually happened before all of these, and it involves that, it involves some sexual misconduct, as you say. We have the new safety director in town. He launched an investigation, farmed out the part about the new acting assistant, I'm sorry, the new acting deputy chief in Circleville to the Lancaster Police Department. They did a pretty quick investigation. There was also a probationary officer involved. He was fired for seeing a woman while on duty. He had been ordered not to see her anymore. Oddly enough, the acting deputy chief was seeing the same woman, maybe not in the same sense, but it was described as flirting, at least. According to the investigation, he would say, hey, do you want to see the new picture of my grandkids, to this woman, who was his daughter's age, by the way, and would hand her his phone, and it was not his grandkids, it was a intimate part of his anatomy.
That's a bait and switch.
Now, this was not the woman he got in trouble with. He actually was having sex with another government employee, including in his unmarked cruiser. So
they tend to frown on that.
He is gone as well. Now, the big question is, okay, is
what
this
happens
just,
now?
Well, is this just going to keep happening in Circleville? There's a lot of praise for the new safety director. He was Worthington's police chief. He came up from Portsmouth. He seems to be a real no-nonsense person. I mean, giving people their due process, but he's not going to let this go on. So they're saying this is actually good news. And the one council member who's criticized a lot of these folks says, I'm hoping that these are the last two bad apples, and hopefully people are taking comfort that we're getting these people out of the department. Now, what they clearly need is lots and lots of training because they are very young and very inexperienced.
Finally, the dispute over boneless chicken wings in Ohio is back in the news. Senator Bill DeMora has introduced a bill that would create a test for restaurants and suppliers' liability for food with harmful substances. Shane, it's a Democratic bill in the final weeks. Is it going anywhere?
Likely not, especially if it's a Senate Democratic bill, and they're even more in the minority than the House. But it brings attention to the issue after the Supreme Court famously, in a 4-3 decision earlier this year, voted that boneless chicken wings can have bones in them.
It's a cooking style, not a guarantee that there are no bones in your chicken, so chew carefully.
Waiting for the court ruling on whether boneless chicken wings are actually chicken nuggets or not, but that's another
that's a whole other debate.
Controversial
or
issue.
Fingers.
Or chicken fingers, it's up to the courts to decide.
Yeah, I once saw a debate over whether tacos were sandwiches.
Oh, man, that's above my pay grade.
I know.
Or a cereal, a soup.
Ooh. These are the things that the great legal minds of our time contemplate. I want to say thank you to Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com.
Pleasure to be here.
And as we sign off, I want to take a moment to say thank you to longtime Roundtable regular Daryl Roland. He's covered Ohio politics for decades and bore witness to many, many first drafts of history. He even hired me at the Dispatch when my family and I moved back to Ohio. So I can safely say you wouldn't be hearing me now were it not for Daryl. And here at All Sides, we just want to say that we've long appreciated your political coverage, your insight, and your friendship. And as it appears, things are closing on your career here. I wanted to give you the final word.
Well, I appreciate that, Anna. And yes, you were my last hire, probably of my career. So, yeah, I think she worked out all right, don't you think, listeners? I can hear all the pause coming around Central Ohio right now. Well, thank you. So, as many of you know, I worked for the Dispatch for over 30 years. They eliminated my job and the job of somebody else. I went into the brave world of TV for a little over 2 years. And in TV, I'm not used to this. You sign a contract. So I said, well, get me through the election this year. And The contract is up, so what I'm saying is I'm retiring. My intent is to retire from full-time journalism at the end of this month. So
we wish you all the best, Daryl.
Being on this show has been one of the highlights, honestly. And folks, you've got a treasure here. You have a treasure on Columbus on the Record with Mike Thompson as well.
And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides right here on 89.7 NPR News.